You are living in the future, and in the future, you can buy underwear made out of silver. Yes, it's true. NASA, the U.S. Special Forces, they know all about this. They use it, and you can own it, too. MacWeldon.com. Underwear made out of XT2 silver fibers. Superhero underwear. If you were hiding from the Predator, this is the underwear you would want. Not only would it protect you from his alien heat vision helmet, it would be durable enough to survive days of fashioning primitive weapons in the jungle. And the silver stuff is antimicrobial. It eliminates odor and wicks away moisture so that your nethers are safe from humidity. Mack Weldon, MacWeldon. Their products, sweats, undershirts, socks, it's all high-tech, comfortable, and durable enough for people running marathons, but made for people running to catch the bus. And they have a simple, smart website that makes it very easy to buy some for yourself. And if you don't like your first pair, you can keep it, and they will refund you. No questions asked. So, go to MacWeldon.com right now, and you will get 20% off using the promo code SOSMART. That's SOSMART at MacWeldon.com. MacWeldon. Smart underwear for smart men. Welcome to the You Are Not So Smart podcast, episode 71. This is the fifth episode in a series of episodes, a season of episodes all about logical fallacies. Logical fallacies. That's what we've been talking about for the last few weeks. And if you haven't listened to the last few episodes, I really do recommend you go back and catch yourself up so that you can be totally ready for this episode, which is about a logical fallacy that's kind of complicated. I mean, you're going to understand it because we have three fantastic experts who are going to put it into terms that we can all understand. But it is good to go back, and if you haven't listened to them, get the foundation, the fallacy, the straw man fallacy, the black and white fallacy, and the no true Scotsman fallacy. All of those together will totally prepare you for this episode's fallacy, the Texas sharpshooter fallacy. Just as before, we have three experts on logic and rationality and reasoning and psychology and society, and they are going to explain everything there is to know about the Texas sharpshooter fallacy. Experts, please introduce yourselves.
So my name is Jesse Richardson. I'm the founder of YourLogicalFallacyIs.com, a website that helps people to learn about fallacies and critical thinking generally.
I'm Barbara Drescher. I'm a cognitive psychologist by trade. I taught at the university level, taught cognitive psychology, research methods, and statistics, things like that.
My name is Mike Rignetta. I'm the writer and host of a YouTube show called Idea Channel, which is produced by PBS Digital Studios.
And together we will be exploring this fallacy that I think is best introduced by this spooky example. Abraham Lincoln and John F. Kennedy were both presidents of the United States, elected 100 years apart. Both were shot and killed by assassins who were known by three names, with 15 letters. John Wilkes Booth and Lee Harvey Oswald. And neither killer would make it to the trial. Lincoln had a secretary named Kennedy, and Kennedy had a secretary named Lincoln. They were both killed on a Friday while sitting next to their wives, Lincoln in the Ford Theater, and Kennedy in a Lincoln made by Ford. Both men were succeeded by a man named Johnson. Andrew for Lincoln and Lyndon for Kennedy. Andrew was born in 1808, Lyndon in 1908. What are the odds? Well, the odds are actually pretty good. This is the You Are Not So Smart podcast. My name is David McRaney. I will be your host. And on this episode, we are exploring the Texas sharpshooter fallacy. One of those fallacies that makes clusters of coincidence seem way more meaningful than they really are. And you'll learn all about that. Why it is, how to defend against it, how to prevent committing that fallacy. Up next, after this commercial break. I have always loved learning about how our minds work, and now there is something that is so cool, that is so awesome. I can't wait for you to try this out. It's called The Great Courses Plus. Okay, here we go. I'm at my computer. Let's type in some things here. Oh boy, I am at thegreatcoursesplus.com, and guess what? You can go through the entire catalog of cool stuff they have on offer at this website and just add them to your watch list. Here we go. Click, 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 click. Oh boy, what's in my watch list now? Critical decision making, mastering influence, great ideas of psychology, how we learn, cognitive behavioral therapy, and so many, many more. These are like complete college courses with lots and lots of individual lectures. They're vetted, they're professionally made. Experts in their field teach you about these topics on video. It is the coolest thing ever. You can get wonderful video courses specializing in psychology and sociology, as well as unlimited access to a huge library of the Great Courses lecture series and many other topics taught by top professors. It's called The Great Courses Plus, and right now, they're giving all of my listeners a great offer. You can watch their popular course, Behavioral Economics, When Psychology and Economics Collide, and hundreds of other courses absolutely free. Behavioral Economics, taught by Professor Scott Hutel. This is a course that's so fascinating. It looks at our decision-making processes, what drives the choices we make consciously and even unconsciously. And with the Great Courses Plus, you can watch that and as many different lectures as you want, anytime, anywhere, stream from any internet-connected TV, PC, or through the Great Courses Plus apps. And right now, you can get this. You can stream this and hundreds of others, including this Behavioral Economics one, a $235 value, by the way, for free when you use my special URL, which is, here we go, listen to this, go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/smart. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/smart. And now we return to our program. This is the You Are Not So Smart podcast, and in this episode, we are exploring the Texas sharpshooter fallacy. All of those examples with Kennedy and Lincoln, they sure seemed amazing. I mean, how could they all be coincidences? How could there be that many coincidences? Something has to be happening here, right? Well, when you're befuddled by the Lincoln and Kennedy connections, you neglect to notice all of the things that don't line up. Kennedy and Lincoln, they're different in so many ways. Kennedy was a Catholic and Lincoln was born a Baptist. Kennedy was killed with a rifle, Lincoln with a pistol. Kennedy was shot in Texas, Lincoln in Washington, D.C. Kennedy had lustrous auburn hair and Lincoln had that craggy face topped with that insane hat. And all of these examples, they're just part of thousands of other examples, millions and millions of examples that you completely ignore when you start paying attention to the coincidences that line up. When you draw that bullseye around the clusters. And that's where the Texas sharpshooter fallacy gets its name.
It's named after the idea of a Texan, a sharpshooter, a guy with a gun facing a barn, shoots all of his bullets into the side of the barn, then walks over and draws a target around where the best cluster is to make it look like he is a great sharpshooter when in fact he has decided ahead of time or after the fact where the sort of quality material is based upon what happened.
So this false cause fallacy is essentially coined after a marksman shooting randomly at barns and then painting a bullseye target around the spot where the most bullet holes appear, making it appear as if he's a really good shot. So clusters naturally appear by chance, but they don't necessarily indicate that there's a causal relationship.
And it's a type of overgeneralization that occurs when lots of data points are available and some of them kind of hit the mark. So essentially, the person making the argument cherry picks the data that fits their preconceived notion of, or the thing that they're trying to convince someone of.
Essentially cherry picking a data cluster to suit an argument or finding a pattern to fit the presumption.
You are looking at a huge set of data and you are finding where information has clustered and then not questioning why that information has clustered. One of the examples that I read, which I think is on Wikipedia, it's about a study where they're trying to determine whether or not living near power lines has health effects. Mm-hmm. And they're looking at a range of, I think it was something like 800 ailments. And so within those 800 ailments, they found that people living near power lines had a high incidence of leukemia. And so the conclusion was, okay, so power lines cause leukemia. When really, mathematically speaking, in a group of 800 ailments, it is not only probable but likely that there will be one illness that has a higher incidence.
So one of the best ones is probably Everything Ever by Nostradamus. dude wrote like thousands of obscure esoteric quatrains, and one of them talked about Hister and made allusions to Germany at war. And with the advantage of hindsight, it's been held up as a prophecy of Hitler in World War II. But never mind the fact that Hister is Latin for the Danube rather than the name of a dictator. And we should, of course, ignore all the thousands of other vaguely worded supposed prophecies that aren't able to be quite so conveniently interpreted to rhyme with things that happened after the fact.
So it's actually pretty common in science, even in the soft sciences, especially.
The file drawer effect.
If you get a scientist who is very conclusion-driven, they're actually trying to prove something, which is not a very good way to think scientifically, but it does happen. If you make enough comparisons, for example, if you study enough variables, some of them, just purely because uncommon things happen or rare things happen, some of them are going to come out, you're going to find something.
Only studies that result in statistically significant results are published, thereby somewhat misrepresenting the reality.
And that doesn't necessarily mean that what you found is supports what you're trying to say. But they'll latch onto those things and say, CO is right. So in those cases, it can be proactively corrected using the appropriate statistical analysis. So sometimes it just happens accidentally. And it can be corrected for it very easily. And that's one of the reasons why we have lots of different ways to adjust for looking at really big data sets and looking at lots of different variables at once.
And there's been some interesting work done by Ben Goldacre and a few other people around the world attempting to get studies that have essentially produced null results to be published as well, so that we can get an idea of where the noise to signal is. Because if you might have an outlier situation of something, if 20 trials have been done on something and it's come up with a null result, and then there's one that has come up with a positive result, perhaps because of some confounding factor that hasn't been accounted for, it looks like, oh, we've got proof that this thing works.
You essentially have your conclusion ahead of time. That you know, like these people doing the study of near the power lines weren't looking for leukemia; they happened upon it. Mm-hmm. But there's another sort of version of the Texas sharpshooter, which is you are looking for the cluster of data that proves whatever your original conclusion is.
A good kind of clean example to help you with the definition is that a broken clock is right twice a day. Okay, so somebody who wants to show that this clock works, they're going to use those two data points, and they're going to ignore all the times when the clock is wrong. And this can happen on purpose, or it can happen without somebody even realizing it, simply because they are conclusion driven in their thinking. So they're looking for ways to prove their points. So they find the data points that actually support them. And then they use that and say, okay, here, this is why I'm right.
Yeah. You know, I often bring up the Lincoln and Kennedy examples, you know, the,
yeah.
look how they're exactly the same.
Yeah.
And, I recently, even with people talking about like the new Star Wars movie, and they go through how this is exactly the same as the first Star Wars movie. and I'm like, oh, this is Texas Sharpshooter, but I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be that guy.
Yeah, especially over Star Wars, because, you know.
Right. But I'm like, you're just finding everything that's exactly, you're just finding the data points that match up your hypothesis, and you're saying, and ha, here it is, and ignoring everything that doesn't match. And
it's true.
It's so easy to
do. It's very easy to do. And that's one of the reasons why it's so common. And we don't even realize that it's common, but it's you see it everywhere. I mean, you see it with things like people who talk to the dead, like John Edwards. Okay. If you actually go and sit in the audience, the man misses a lot. But then when you see this show, they edit out all the misses and all you get are the hits. And that makes you believe that he's psychic. It's the proof that he's psychic. And this is cherry picking.
And it's interesting, isn't it, that it's kind of like it, I think it it exposes our propensity to recognize patterns after the fact, and our inclination to want to see some kind of signal where we are attempting to, I don't know, in some way make it apparent that we've found something that makes sense to us, to our anecdotal circumstantial mind.
It's a matter of in order to spot it, even sometimes you have to understand the statistics if they're using a lot of numbers. Sometimes you have to understand the sampling methods that they used. Sometimes you just can't know. And if you don't know the field, it becomes very difficult then to even spot.
And I think that that actually, just to step back, like one or two points, that I think, you know, you really do see the Texas Sharpshooter a lot with statistics.
Yeah.
A lot with statistics. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's another really like I think that might be a fallacy in and of itself, which is just that statistics, it represent the truth. And that there's a big strategy or I don't know, attitude, something where it's like, if you have the statistics that say a thing, and you have enough of the statistics that center around a particular thing, you have created the truth.
Mm-hmm.
You have proven your point. And so it's almost like sharpshooter on sharpshooter fallacy,
mm-hmm.
where it's like, if you have enough, and like the thing that has generated the statistics may be an example of the sharpshooter fallacy. And then you have enough of those fallacious statistics come together to create another level of the Texas sharpshooter mm-hmm. fallacy. That then when you say to people like, well, I don't know, like, but aren't there a lot of things outside of this? What are the counter arguments? It is almost like you are insulting the truth. Like you're telling them that objective reality doesn't exist.
Uh-huh.
And I've had this experience a lot where when you call into question how statistics are framed or how statistics relate to one another, people get really, really uncomfortable. Or a certain kind of person will get very, very uncomfortable.
I think my absolute favorite example is the other than the Lincoln Kennedy thing is the Titan, the futility, is a book called the Futility or The Wreck of the Titan. It's a 1890s novel about a giant ship that hits an iceberg and sinks. And it is, so it's written long before the actual Titanic, and there's a lot of similarities you can pull out of it. And people point out those similarities and say, this is impossible. Was this person seeing the future? But they discount that of the like 20 similarities, there's 20,000 dissimilarities.
Exactly right.
And it's so easy to do that. You can almost do that with any two books or any two movies or any two anything, if you just want to pick out the similarities and disregard the dissimilarities. And so in that way, it's very similar to cold reading and all sorts of other things mm-hmm. that do this hits and misses thing that we're so programmed, so tuned in to notice, and we sort of it's just how we, one of the ways we tend to make sense of the world. And if you turn that up to 11, you get all these strange things that you start to believe are predictions of the future or whatever.
This is the, I mean, like anyone who's read your book, David, I think has come to the conclusion that they shouldn't trust their brain. And I think it's quite a revelatory thing for a lot of people to understand that we actually aren't intuitively very good at pattern recognition. We aren't intuitively very good at making rational sense of the world. We actually need to invest a mindset and do work to attempt to counteract what biases we have, either naturally or through cultural indoctrination. And it's disconcerting, I think, for a lot of people, because we have this idea our whole lives before we challenge these thoughts that we are rational agents, that we are these, you know, like we are capable of seeing things clearly and coherently and logically and honestly. And when we start to tease apart and look at, oh, actually, my intuition there doesn't gel at all with reality, there's actually something wrong with my hardware and my software that I'm not interpreting this in a realistic way. And I need tools. I need to consciously interfere with my intuition to be able to arrive at a more clear understanding of what's going on.
Yeah. And that's so true in every way. And especially the part about my books and the thing is, any one of these fallacies that has to do with statistics, or anything that has to do with statistics anyway, that's when you really get into the portions of our thinking that are so bad. And we have such strong intuitions that we are great at statistics, that we have, and we trust that intuitive response to just about any statistical problem. That's why Texas Sharpshooter is so powerful, because it's like a mega example of how poor we are at disassembling statistical data.
Absolutely. And I think with all the fallacies, what I find most interesting about them is what they expose about our psychology. And it's like, apart from, I mean, the fallacies themselves are, you know, these quite discrete logical constructs, and, you know, there being a fault in that. But there's a much deeper level underneath that, about why. Why do we commit these fallacies? Why are we prone to these biases? Why are we so bad at actually trying to understand an argument clearly and coherently? We all, obviously, at point blank, you ask someone, do you want the truth of things? Do you want to actually understand it? And we all do. Of course we do. No one wants to be beholden to, you know, something that actually doesn't make sense or is a lie or is outdated thinking or anything like that. We all have this conscious idea that we want to update our thinking, that we want to be, you know, rational, sensible people. But in practice, we employ so many of these faulty mechanisms of thought, and it really requires a conscious intervention to be able to disrupt that process and that inclination.
Nothing has been better than that aspect of this where you start to have that shared humility with other human beings. Mm-hmm. And for me, it feels very nice to be able to admit that we start from that place, saying that maybe I don't know everything and maybe I have a lot to learn. And so I find it's very freeing for me to look at things in this way.
And I think people, like, we presume that, you know, I said that you have to do work and there's a conscious intervention, which makes it sound like a drag. But really, I agree with you. It's a really pleasant and rewarding experience to, you know, divest of yourself the idea that you have to be right about everything. There's a tension and a stress with that you have to constantly justify things. If you're okay with being wrong, then it's okay, you know? You're not invested in that anymore, and you're not stressed by, you know, having to justify whatever dogmatic beliefs you may have accidentally picked up along the way. And I think you're right, though, that there's this cultural kind of precept, and it extends to definitely Australian culture as well. But I think that it's an artifact of Western cultural thought to a large extent, perhaps more, most sort of like prevalently in American culture, this idea of individualism and the hero's sort of perspective of things. And we have such a strong cultural reinforcement of this idea that the hero prevails, you know. I, the individual, are going to, you know, through all this adversity and conflict, I'm going to come through and there'll be like orchestral music at the end, angels will sing, everything will be resolved. You know, there's this guy, and it goes really deep with us, you know, whereas the kind of idea that, oh, maybe I'm wrong about things, I don't know, you know, like that humility is a much less celebrated aspect of our cultural identity and our psyche as a result. And I think it's something that has so much value and is so, as you say, liberating and freeing to be able to be okay with the idea that you might be wrong.
How can you better spot the Texas sharpshooter fallacy out there in the wild?
So I think the trick is to look at people's motives. So whenever like statistical data is being proffered to you, question what the agenda of that person is. Is there a profit motive? Is there a dogmatic ideological motive? All these kinds of things. And if it's kind of apparent that there might be, then it's probably a good cue to have a look at, okay, well, this is what's being presented to me, but let's think about where's the noise to the signal in proportion? Where's the what else might be a confounding factor in terms of how this conclusion has been arrived at? And it's often difficult to do, you know, like Google's your friend, but you might not have access to all of the scholarly articles and whatever else. So I think a healthy dose of skepticism is wise all of the time whenever we're looking at these sorts of things, and all the more so when someone has an agenda to push and they're professing to be the authority on something statistically. It's wise to have a measure of doubt.
So what is your advice for the average person to avoid committing this fallacy?
Well, to avoid committing the fallacy, you really want to try to use scientific thinking and use it properly. And you always want to do that whenever you're thinking about anything about what's true about the world or arguing anything. Always use good scientific thinking. And good scientific thinking is not conclusion driven. We don't, we start with what we think is true, which is our working hypothesis, but we don't seek to confirm that hypothesis. We actually, the scientific approach is to try to disconfirm, but we let the data tell us what is not true. And so you always want to approach everything with an open mind and not try to look for the things that prove your point, because that's where you'll always go wrong. If you're, you know, preparing a talk about, you know, just something that irks you about the world, the way to prepare that talk is to actually look at the evidence, not to then Google it and then take the bits from the things that you agree with. And we should all know this already, but yet we all do it.
So I think whenever you're looking for a pattern, it pays to play devil's advocate to see if the pattern you're seeing might be explained by randomity. I think that's the central sort of idea that is the takeaway in terms of this fallacy and our bias toward committing it. If we try to, you know, think to ourselves, okay, I can see this connection here, but I'm aware that my brain is not to be trusted, and therefore, you know, could this be explained by random chance? And would we expect to see that, you know, if random chance were put out over the sample size, it can help to at least offset the effect.
Yeah. And it's good. Supposedly Carl Sagan said that randomness is clumpy, and whether or not he said it, it's a good thing to remember that
totally.
if you're looking at a large enough data set, it's going to clump up in weird ways. And our inclination is to say, ah, there's a thing that's important. There it is right there. Mm. So just be aware that your brain does that. And it may or may not actually be worth going down that rabbit hole.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're on the receiving end of this, if someone is using this to argue against you, is there a good way to say, to raise up a flag and let someone realize, hey, wait, you're committing this well-known fallacy?
That this one is very tough with this one. Even if you recognize that it's happening, it can be really difficult to counter this if you're not familiar with the data. If you don't know what the other points are, then it's very difficult to do. But try to think about what the person might be missing, and then just ask those questions. You know, for example, are they using a lot of anecdotes? Because anecdotes tend to feed into this whole sharpshooter idea, because that's all data points are. Data is just a bunch of anecdotes put together. So if you think about it that way, that's really true. The plural of anecdote is data. That's a misnomer that it's not. So if they're using a lot of anecdotes, then there's probably, for every anecdote they come up with, there's probably five more that are outside of that target zone. Never do just one group of data points, prove a point, unless you're looking at them in the context of a full data set. And unless you don't know what, unless you know what you're looking for, unless you know that there's a full data set there and that there might be data points outside of that target, it can be really difficult to do. So you just have to be thinking in those terms, thinking about what they might be missing, what may not be being, what explanations may not be entering into the argument. And if you can think that way, you may not know the answer, but at least you can ask those questions.
Wow, that's a tough one.
It is. It's a very tough one.
So I think a simple sort of tactic that you can use is to explain it, is to say, if a data cluster like you're talking about didn't happen in a sample size this big, that would be amazing. And I think turning the tables on it way helped to elucidate that, okay, yeah, well, like, not only is our statistics clumpy, but also, if there wasn't something that, if there wasn't this kind of cluster somewhere, then it would be absurd. And so that can help to make the variation that we see in large data sets more intuitively apparent, I think.
Mm-hmm. It's the verb of, it's the very active statistical version of confirmation bias, where you are.
Yeah, exactly.
You have a premise, you're engaging in motivated reasoning, and you're trying to, you're looking for a thing, and instead of looking for the thing, you just look for clusters, and then you draw the circle around them. It's the after the factness of it that makes it so problematic.
Yeah.
My favorite example of the Texas sharpshooter fallacy is the Bermuda Triangle, because you can draw a triangle anywhere on the earth and get about as many missing planes.
But, oh, that's really good. I didn't know that. Yeah.
Yeah. So the
makes perfect sense.
But there you go. We were like this. And so we were like, another plane went down in the Bermuda Triangle.
And then frequency illusion plays into that, right?
Where right,
you're,
right.
Where you're like, oh man, another one in the Bermuda Triangle.
Yes.
Like, when you're looking for it, you'll find it.
And we bid farewell to our three experts. In the next five episodes, you will hear from three new experts on logical fallacies and thinking in general. Their names, again, if you want to keep up with them, if you want to find them out there in the world, Jesse Richardson, Barbara Drescher, and Mike Rugnetta. You can find them at icbseverywhere.com, yourlogicalfallacyis.com, and PBS Idea Channel on YouTube. More information about what they do and logical fallacies in general at youarenotsosmart.com and the show notes for this and all the other episodes. And speaking of that, if you have enjoyed these last five episodes on logical fallacies, or the last 71 episodes on all sorts of things in the world of psychology and self-delusion and judgment and decision-making and reason, you can support this show on Patreon by going to patreon.com/youarenotsosmart. Just $1 will get you in the door, and you'll get access to all of the extras for these episodes. I'm going to put up lots and lots of stuff that I didn't get to in these interviews. We went off topic, and we went on all these tangents about different ideas. I'll put all of that into the extras, and the patrons, they get to listen to extras for the show. Sometimes they're even longer than the shows themselves. So check out all that at patreon.com/youarenotsosmart. All right. After this music fades out, a commercial, a cookie, and then the credits. Cookies.
Building a website can be tough. Even if you do know your way around coding, creating something that looks good and works well, it's a time-consuming affair. Whether it's for a business website, a portfolio, a restaurant, whatever. In this day and age, you need one. You can't just depend on social media. Well, lucky for us, Squarespace makes it easy to build beautiful websites without breaking a sweat. Squarespace provides simple, powerful, and beautiful websites that look professionally designed, regardless of your skill level, with no coding required. Not only does Squarespace provide you with intuitive and easy-to-use tools to create your website, Squarespace also has state-of-the-art technology powering your site to ensure security and stability. And you know you can trust in Squarespace for your website needs when millions of people and some of the most respected brands in the world trust in them too. Now, I use Squarespace for my personal website. I wanted something that was easy to update. If something changed, if I wanted to add something, if I wanted to give some news, some information, I wanted to be able to go click, 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 and then pow, it's there, it's done. If I make a change, it is instantaneously on the website and it looks fantastic. Seriously, you cannot beat the ease and simplicity of Squarespace. Squarespace gives you 24/7 online support and a beautiful website. So look, what are you waiting for? Start a trial with no credit card required and start building your website today. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use this offer code, SOSMART. You will get 10% off of your first purchase. And it shows your support for this podcast. They get a little thing that says, hey, look, somebody from You're Not So Smart got the 10% off offer. It helps us both. So we thank Squarespace for their support of You Are Not So Smart. And we urge you, build your next website at squarespace.com. And now we return to the program.
Starts with the letter C. Cookie starts with C. Let's think of other things that starts with C. Who cares about other things? C is for cookie. That's
in each episode of the You Are Not So Smart C podcast, I eat a cookie baked from a recipe sent in by a listener or a reader by email. You send those recipes to david@youarenotsosmart.com. And if we pick your recipe and we bake it and I eat it, you get a signed copy of the You Are Not So Smart book in the mail to your house or apartment or wherever you may be living. You get a signed copy of either You Are Not So Smart or You Are Now Less Dumb. So in this episode, the cookie that we're tasting comes from Anton Angelo, who writes, "Hi, David. Thank you so much for your podcast. You're right up there with," and he mentions some other podcasts, Brian Cox's Infinite Monkey Cage, In Our Time with Melvin Bragg, Mark Kermode, is that how you say his name? Mark Kermode? Mark Kermode's film reviews. And that is very nice of you. Those are some really great, smart, super cool people and great podcasts. I don't know if I deserve to be among those, but I thank you so much for saying that you listen to that as a suite and I am part of it. That is so cool. He says, here's a recipe that you might be interested in. They have a great history as well as being my absolute favorites. He says in this email, they are a take on the little spice cookies really common in some parts of Europe over Christmas. Some even make fancy shapes and hang them from their Christmas trees. The New Zealand version gets two plain spice cookies, slaps jam in between, and makes it a sandwich. He says maybe jelly would do, but good raspberry jam with seeds in it is traditional. And you top them off with a bit of fondant icing, and then on top you put a little dusting, a little jello powder. So it's confection fit for a sheep shearer's morning smoko. That's what he writes, which he says is morning tea and a morning snack. Originally, these were called, I'm still reading from this email. Originally, these were called German biscuits, but anti-German sentiment at the beginning of the First World War renamed them Belgium biscuits. Not, as you'll note, Belgian biscuits. Cooked bologna was also renamed Belgium from being previously known as German sausage. And this was in memory of poor Belgium, the first country to be attacked in the Great War, 1914 to 1918. Still reading from this email, this is fantastic. New Zealand had one of the highest casualty rates in the Great War, with more than 100,000 men deployed overseas of a population of 1 million. It became a founding part of the national identity. It's our on
freedom fries if you like. That is so cool. I love, we get all these cookies that have these national identities. They have these pedigrees, and I find it endlessly fascinating. There's a whole world of like culinary anthropology. There's even a world of the psychology related to people's food habits and how food trends come and go. I just love it. I love this world. It's a world I don't know anything about. And every time I learn anything new about it, it is marvelous to me. So these cookies have a billion ingredients, sugar and vanilla essence and cinnamon and spices and ginger and baking powder and red food coloring and jam. It's an intense process. I can't even go into it. Just know this is a complicated affair, but it ends up with a really simple looking, beautiful, polite, petite cookie. And we're going to try it right now, Anton. Here we go.
Mmm. Crumble, crumble, crumble. Belgium.
That's so good. And you know, it's complicated even in the eating of it. It's there's a lot happening in my mouth. My tongue is thinking many different things. My tongue is thinking many things. There's just a lot of different textures and a lot of flavors associated with different textures all happening. It seems so simple on the outside, but it's very complicated once you start chewing. And I forgot to tell you what it looks like. It looks like maybe a gingerbread, a very, very thin gingerbread cookie. Then with it's a sandwich where the bread is gingerbread cookies, and there's raspberry jam in the middle. And on the top, there's just a layer of what would looks kind of like icing, but upon closer inspection, you realize it's part of the cookie itself, and it's got these little red sprinkles on it. It's a really nice cookie. I feel like it's a cookie with manners. This is a cookie that actually listens during conversations instead of waiting for its turn to talk. And this is a cookie that cues very well, forms a line very well, does not like people cutting in front of it, and it opens doors for other cookies. This is a cookie with refined, civilized manners. Unassuming, polite, a very nice cookie. Thank you so much, Anton. I'm actually going to Belgium in a few months to do some lecture stuff. So I really appreciate this is my first introduction to Belgium and the wonderful world of its confections. I hope you are as polite as your cookie has been to my mouth. I don't know what I just said. Oh, a cookie in my mouth means a book is on its way. That is it for this episode of the You Are Not So Smart podcast. Check this out, boingboingpodcasts.com. We've sort of relaunched the network, and so you will find not only this podcast, but Flash Forward, a podcast about the future, takes on future scenarios, Home, stories about Los Angeles, Incredibly Interesting Authors, which is about incredibly interesting authors, Geek, a podcast where editors and friends of Boing Boing talk about media, science, and science fiction and video games and everything else. Look, you've got to check it out. These are all my favorite podcasts. This is a great family to be part of. It's called boingboingpodcasts.com. Head to youarenotsosmart.com for all the show notes and all the previous episodes and everything else you want to know about these shows. Thank you so much for listening. Patreon people, patreon.com/youarenotsosmart.